when these drugs were banned in the States in 67, and there was this campaign to vilify them, we saw that adverse effects went up. So scaring people about these drugs makes them more problematic to use. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Lewis Miller. The mission of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics is to enhance your physical and emotional well-being and encourage community. I say encourage community because I believe that we humans are tribal animals, and we do the best when we live tribally, when we know everybody in our community, if not by name, by face. Then we're cooperative. Then we are collaborative. Then we are creative. And then we are most healthy. But we must keep in mind that there's a very small percentage of us, fortunately small, but extremely powerful, who are very different from the rest of us. These people are predators. They are dominators. They're the ones that came out of the caves with the biggest clubs. They're the ones that eventually became kings. They're the ones that created these false boundaries that we call countries in order to create their property. Because when you look down from space at the world, you don't see countries, you see a planet. That's what we all live on. So we must be aware of these predators and be mindful and do the right thing to protect the rest of us. In the words of my hero, Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Today, I have the extreme privilege of having with us Professor David Nutt, arguably the world's foremost, certainly England's foremost scientist regarding psychedelic medicine. His books, you want to look up on Google, you'll see some of them on the screen behind him. You want to look up his contributions that he's made to this cause that's been going on, if not 50 years in my lifetime, much longer than that. Why is that? Because the antecedents of the war against drugs goes back past the Women's Christian Temperance Union, goes back almost to the founders. Benjamin Rush, psychiatrist, some consider the father of modern psychiatry, said, if angels in heaven could see the amount of drinking going on, they would spin around on their clouds. He was like the ancestor of the Christian Temperance Union. And now, in the last 50 or 60 years, we have had this tremendous suppression of science, which this scientist today has felt and suffered, and we're going to talk about it. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, David.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Richard. Thanks for inviting me.
David, what I want to talk about quite a bit today, but it doesn't have to be everything we talk about, are the adverse effects of psychedelics. And here's the reason why. In this country, the United States, well, everybody should know that you're in England. And thank you for that, because there's a 9-hour time difference and it's getting late your time. In our country, the big pharmaceutical companies, when they have adverse effects, they do everything they can to sanitize them. They even came up with this terminology, side effects, as if it happens on the side and it's trivial. But we all know in science that these negative effects or adverse effects don't happen just on the side, on our ribs. They happen to the entire system. They do their best to hide. I believe, and I know you do too, that in our cause, science of psychedelic medicine, we want to be transparent and let the public know what's going on about adverse effects. So we'll jump into that in a minute or two. But first, what are your thoughts on the political situation and the antecedents of the suppression of science, both in your country and my country, for over 50 years? What are we dealing with, David?
Well, we're dealing with what I have said repeatedly is the worst censorship of research and clinical treatment in the history of the world. And just reflecting on your introduction, Richard, the whole purpose of the prohibition of psychedelics was to stop people living together, to stop people trying to break down those false barriers between nation peoples. It was to maintain the status quo, and psychedelics were seen as a serious threat to the, essentially, the post-World War II position of continuing fighting proxy wars in places like Vietnam. So, as I often say, LSD was the first and only drug really to be banned because it changed the way people voted and the way people thought about international politics. And all the other psychedelics got sucked in with LSD because they had similar pharmacology. So it is truly the most horrific imposition of a political will on research there's ever been. And let's not be honest, it's still there. These drugs are still illegal in your country. They're illegal in my country. In fact, they're illegal in every country in the world, with the exception of a couple of Latin American countries where the natural product equivalents are available. So although we're doing more research now, it's still at a cost. And if we were to change the regulations and the schedules, we get an awful lot more work done.
David, fill in the dots for our listeners who don't know. What is the connection between taking LSD and changing the way you vote?
Well, it really starts with the anti-Vietnam War protests. So as I guess most of your listeners will know, that was an American war that was being fought in Southeast Asia. Young men, aged 18, were being sent based on the date of their birth to fight a war against an enemy they might never see for a cause they didn't understand in very, very unpleasant conditions. And many of them were protesting, and they were escaping the draft. Some went to Canada, and quite a few went to the West Coast, where at the time, psychedelic use was beginning to rise in those days called the hippies. And people like Timothy Leary were arguing that people should tune in and turn on and then drop out and avoid being part of the military. And you saw these very powerful placards, drop acid, not bombs. And of course, at that time, there was a vast amount of bombing going on in Laos and Cambodia, as well as in Vietnam. And the American governments, both Johnson, the Democrat, and then Nixon, the Republican, didn't want to stop the war because that's the only philosophy or international diplomacy they knew how to perpetuate. And they couldn't stop the anti-war protests because people have a right. I think you have the First Amendment. You can say what you like. But what they did do was to ban the drugs that they thought were fueling the anti-war protests, or at least encouraging people to be more radical in terms of wanting peace, not war. So they banned the psychedelics. And of course, the Vietnam War ended somewhat later, but it did end. But the ban on psychedelics persists, because it turns out it's very easy to ban a drug. Very, very, very hard to unban it.
Why is it that in our country, both political parties have been very suppressive and negative about various kinds of psychedelic medicines, but the people on the far right seem to be even more violently opposed than the people on the left? What's your opinion on where they're coming from? What is it that they feel they either have to protect, or how are they going to make more money? What's the motivation?
Well, I think historically, drug prohibition has been fueled by economic desires. I mean, the whole concept of having drugs, the plant-based drugs made illegal, is kind of absurd to most people. If things grow naturally, you sort of think, well, perhaps people should be allowed to have access to them. But if we go back to the 1800s, we see the rise of big pharma. We see particularly German pharmaceutical companies like Bayer taking a plant, a bark, willow bark, and turning the salicylic acid into a slightly modified version, acetyl salicylic acid, patenting that as aspirin, and then pushing through medicines controls not to allow other forms of painkiller. We saw the same with opium in the opium poppy, getting the extract, calling it morphine, stopping access to opium. The hostility to particularly Chinese using opium in the turn of the 1900s was you know, largely driven by the pharmaceutical companies wanting to maintain a monopoly on the use of those kind of painkillers. And we've seen, you know, seen similar things developing subsequently. So yes, so there's an enormous amount of money invested in pharmaceuticals, and the ones, those who run it don't want to change. But then if you go beyond that, if you go to the this whole question of sort of right v left, I mean, internationally, it doesn't really matter. It's extremism that really is anti-drug. It's the people in the middle who care about others rather than try to perpetuate their own particular myths of excellence of the problem. But I think in your country, the right wing tends to be a Protestant, and Protestants tend to be rather hostile to having pleasures on this earth because they believe, probably wrongly, they get pleasures in the next. But I'm not sure even if there is a next, they'll know how to enjoy the pleasures if they get there.
Well, yeah, my take on that, David, is that offering the pleasures in the next is a way of controlling the behavior in the now, because you tell people, if you do what we tell you and play by the rules that we tell you to play by, then you're going to go to a good place in the next. But if you don't play by our rules, you're going to go to a very bad place. And so they threaten them. And then what we have in this country, I can't speak for other countries because I'm not international that way, but what we have in this country is a tremendous number of people who are anxious and depressed when it comes to their transitioning into the next place. They're afraid of dying. Instead of looking at dying as part of the process of living, they look at it as something to be afraid of. And the reason is simple, David. All of us have sinned. So they know they've sinned, and they figure, well, I guess I'm going to hell.
Yes. I mean, it's the extreme, harsh religion. It can be very, very traumatizing to children. Can I share an anecdote with you?
Please. I'd love it.
20 years ago, I was in a big conference in Paris with a number of eminent leading American researchers. And then one evening, you know, we're sitting around to dinner. I said, what did you guys get up to? We had the afternoon free. And they said, oh, we went to Notre Dame. And I said, wow, what a magnificent church, isn't it? And they said, yes, but we went in and it brought back the traumas of us going to a Catholic school and being confronted with guilt and violence. And they're actually really rather disturbed by the memories coming back of that being taught by monks and nuns who were very, really cruel and destructive to their hopes with those predictions. You know, you're all going to go to hell anyway, whatever you do. So, and these are eminent psychiatrists who've kind of should have worked it through, but it does leave an enduring impact. But childhood trauma is really, it penetrates the mind.
I remember a quote from one of the popes who said, give me a child from 0 to 6 and you can have him for the rest of his life, but he'll always be mine. Yes. And that's basically what you're saying. Are things changing? Are people becoming more moderate with regard to their religious beliefs in England? Or is it more of the same?
Well, I think people are, yes, there is a more of a sense that of the point you made at the beginning. More, I mean, religion started off as community. I think the word church actually means community. And it's what has happened over the centuries is that the church has become a business, and businesses, you know, tend to focus on money rather than the people that they're serving. I think we're beginning to change that. Even some evangelical churches are growing up. But there's a there's an interesting movement, which I think is very relevant to the question of psychedelics, which is a lot of people now are describing themselves as spiritual, but not religious. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what the original religious believers were. They had this sort of spiritual sense that there was more and that there were people that they could follow, like Jesus, but they weren't involved in forcing others to do the same thing. They were involved in encouraging togetherness. And I think we're beginning to move back into that direction now.
I think that's happening in this country as well. It may seem slow to those of us who have what's called a limited time, you know, 60 to 80 or 90 years, but in Earth time, it might be moving quickly. We really don't know in terms of the development. Let's switch topics now, if I may, and ask you, what's presently on your radar screen? What's holding your interest as a scientist these days?
What you mean in addition to my own work? Because that's...
No, in your work, what aspect of your work is holding your interest right now? What are you involved with?
Well, I'm very pleased to say that we will shortly be starting a trial of psilocybin in people with heroin addiction. And to my mind, most people know that addiction to opiates is a very, very tough thing to break. And I'm hopeful that psychedelics might be able to do that. They might be able to help people reframe their attitude to those drugs and be able either to stop using or use less. So that's we're gearing up to do that, start that in a couple of months, which is very exciting.
That is very exciting. I spent 10 years of my 60-year career in chemical dependence. I started a program, a pioneering program called Cokeenders Alcohol and Drug Program, where I demonstrated to the world that the 28-day programs are nothing more than a deal between the hospitals and the insurance companies. And I did the detox in 5 days, but that's for another time. But what I want to share with you, going into your research on the heroin people, is that what I discovered is dealing with their use of the particular chemical, be it I treated heroin, cocaine, and alcohol primarily. Dealing with the use of the particular material is one aspect of the job. But the other aspect of the job, which I think psychedelics could also help immensely, is the lifestyle that they take on when they're using the drugs. So it isn't simply a matter of stopping, because if you become, say, a liar or a cheat or a thief or slovenly, or your personal habits have gone, it doesn't mean because you stop, all of a sudden you're going to clean up your act and be an honest person or be honest with your partner, right? So these skills need to be relearned. And I believe...
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And this is a whole new paradigm. And there's some reasonably good evidence now of psychedelics in alcohol. And this, we'll be doing the first study in heroin addiction. But you're absolutely right. Up till now, the treatments we have generally been using have been about stopping people using, but not actually changing the way they view things, and not dealing with some of the traumas which led them to use, not dealing with all the complications that being a drug addict or an alcoholic brings to your life, the disruption of your family and your work and your children, etc. Psychedelics, I think, can help people completely reframe not just their attitude to the drug, but also to the way, as you say, that they have become. And they can, we see this in other disorders, like in depression, they can, after the trip, they can come out with a very much more positive view of themselves and other people. So they can re-engage in society in a much more positive way.
I read in your book a particular comment that really got my antenna waving when you pointed out that if you have depression And the depression comes from early childhood trauma or other trauma earlier in your life. The psychedelic may lift the depression, but at a certain point, if you don't do the work to uncover the origin, you're going to be depressed again. And I thought that was an extremely important point to make for the public, because part of what's going on here in this renaissance, in another form, gold rush, is that naive people are thinking, I've got a panacea here. I'll go for a weekend and I'll be done. You know, or they hear about Roland's work at Johns Hopkins, where the people were still less depressed a year later after one or two psilocybin trips. Yes. Comment to us about that, please.
Well, yes, I think the impact of psychedelics, say, on depression can vary dramatically. I mean, you know, it can vary from people sort of resetting themselves to individuals who do get powerful insights, but as you say, uncover the traumas that they need to deal with. And our experience is that people who perhaps become depressed as a result of a single experience, for instance, a divorce or losing your job, you know, later in life, they can reframe their attitude to that after a trip and stay very well. Those in whom early trauma has sort of patterned the brain in this rather self-critical, negative way, the psychedelics can help them lift out of the depression, but the depression seems to come back. It's like it's always trying to control their brain. And we therefore have to work very hard to do two things. One is to help them deal with those thoughts when they come back, but also to try to make them get into situations where they can regain the lost lives. I mean, many of them have lost 10 or 20 years of proper, normal social interaction because of their illness and the trauma. So it's about not dealing with that inner experience and also re-engaging with a life that they've sort of been denied.
So would you say that people who became depressed later in life, but not because of early trauma, but because of more current events, would have an easier time recovering from the depression? And the reason I ask that, David, is because in the United States, I talked to an epidemiologist from Johns Hopkins recently, and she told me that best they can tell, 30 to 40% of the United States right now is suffering from anxiety and depression. And that's post-pandemic. Because what we did here was we took tribal animals who were very social and we forced alienation on them by having them go into their caves alone and for lengthy periods of time.
Yeah.
And so there's an enormous amount of suffering.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, it was more than just that. It was also, for many of us, we lost confidence in our leaders. Yeah, we lost confidence in the ability of this amazing technology we have in medicine and in science to actually solve a problem. If anything, it seemed to make it worse. So, and also, of course, we also have the sort of parallel paradox of people being anti-science, even when the science was trying to help them. So, yeah, so I think that those individuals could well find that the psychedelic is very helpful in dealing with that particularly circumscribed period of trauma through COVID. That's one of the reasons I'm really keen to get the regulations changed so we can more extensively roll out this therapy, because there are so many people. I mean, it's been estimated that maybe a third of all doctors and nurses that were working in intensive care have got PTSD as a result of having to deal with a virus which they didn't understand, for which they weren't prepared, and not getting the support from the health authorities that they needed.
Yeah, I'm hopeful with that that MDMA is going to make it through, but every year Rick tells me they're stalling him off for another year. He's been telling me that for 36 years.
I think he's there. I'm really I think he's there. It would be extraordinary, I think, if he didn't get FDA approval now with so much work and such good outcomes. I mean, I think the problem will be actually getting payers to pay rather than I think the FDA will support it.
Does the United States put huge pressure on England to suppress psychedelic science, or are you people doing it on your own? Are you suppressing yourselves on your own without our help?
Yeah, I think we're backward now. I mean, until 2016, from the sort of 1930s, almost all our drug laws were made because of US pressure. But now we're making even more stupid decisions ourselves because we have a right-wing government, and right-wing governments, you know, like to attack drugs and drug users because what's there not to like? You know, drug users are bad people and drugs are dangerous. So the Nixon war on drugs is being fought here, but we're fighting it over trivial drugs like nitrous oxide and benzodiazepines, which is very sad.
You're fighting them over benzodiazepines as well? Pharmaceuticals?
Well, recreational use of benzos.
I see. I have a professional interest in obsessive compulsive disorder, so I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you can share with us about the use of psychedelics with OCD.
So we've just finished, or just about finished, a small study. I won't tell you exactly the design because there's a couple of patients still about to finish. But it was a study in which we took people with OCD and we gave them a non-psychedelic dose, what we would call a psycholytic dose.
Yes.
Psilocybin, a 10 milligram dose on a couple of occasions. And the reason we did that was because our patients said, look, are you seriously asking us to lose control with under a trip? You know, you must be crazy. You know, our whole disorder is about maintaining control. So we compromised, and you can't force people to have a trip, and if they didn't want to, we couldn't have made them. So what we did was we gave them this lower dose, and it turned out that it was actually quite emotionally liberating. So we gave them the dose, and then we engaged them in various therapeutic exposure type activities to see if we could facilitate their psychotherapy. And many of them did have quite profound insights, because even a non-psychedelic dose will break down that enormous resistance that they're, in fact, which is dominating their life. I mean, people with OCD spend their whole life working out how not to do things. And psychedelics began to break that down and made them, I think, at the very least, see that they could be different. Because with OCD, the repetitive behavior is so ingrained that they often think that they cannot ever change. And then just for a few hours under the psilocybin, they could think differently. So I'm quite positive about it. I think it might be a good stepping stone to more intensive kind of interventions.
Do you think if there were people suffering from OCD who would be willing to take a larger dose and lose control, that would be an interesting experiment? Because it would be paradoxical to their condition and maybe in line with what that Polish scientist Dombrowski called positive disintegration.
Well, yes, I think knowing that the thing is, people come back, there is that sense of disintegration under psychedelics, but almost everyone comes back in a better way. So we have to, but people have to trust us if that's going to happen. I think it's very likely that people with OCD who were prepared to have a full trip would do quite well out of it, better out of it. But I am impressed with the impact of that sub-psychedelic dose. And it may be that a few of those could give you a similar kind of outcome with less anxiety, less worry about the risk of losing control.
Yes. Of course, for therapists, psycholytic doses are a lot more fun, because the person is conversational, whereas psychedelic doses, you're sitting with somebody who's inside their head for the whole 6 to 8 hours. There's not much to do. The best thing you can do is keep your mouth shut.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. There's no question. You shouldn't speak until spoken to if someone's having a trip, because right. you usually just mess things up.
So I guess we need to talk about adverse effects.
Yes.
Because one of the ways the suppressors scare people is by focusing on adverse effects and magnifying them as if they're happening all the time and they're really terrible. Mm. So let's take some moments and let you go through some of the classic psychedelics and tell us what you will about negative or adverse effects from each of them. Fair enough?
I will do that. Yeah, no, very clear. But before I do that, when these drugs were banned in the States in 67, and there was this campaign to vilify them, we saw that adverse effects went up. So scaring people about these drugs makes them more problematic to use. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's very difficult, even if you're cynical, not to believe it, to think that the government's just lying to you continuously. You've always got a sense maybe there's some truth in what they say. So anyway, so the reality is that the adverse effects of psychedelics can be powerfully influenced by social norms and social beliefs, etc. We're trying to break away from that now. So, I mean, when we look at what goes on in our clinical setting, the commonest adverse effect is a headache. That usually lasts for the trip and maybe for a few hours after. Can occasionally be an issue if you're a migraineur. You know, that may be a bit of a concern. I'm not entirely sure how we should deal with people who have severe migraines. But then you've got this paradox that people with severe other kinds of headaches, like cluster headaches, they often benefit from psychedelics. So that's a very complicated area. But headache, nausea.
Let me ask about headaches before we go on. How prevalent? 80%? 40%?
Yeah, we found about, I think it was about 70% had some kind of headache. I mean, not so that they needed treatment.
And we're talking with LSD or across the board?
Well, I was thinking mostly of psilocybin.
Psilocybin, 70% headaches?
I about had reported headaches during the trip, yeah. But
well,
again,
makes me feel like a very lucky guy. I've taken it probably over 100 times, and I've never had a headache.
Yeah. Well, that may be why you've been able to take. Yeah, who knows? Let's not go there.
70% is a high number, so that's a good thing for people to know.
But they're self-limiting, and they don't need medication.
It sounds like it's the psychedelic medicine is causing some form of inflammation in these people.
I think it is probably a kind of migrainous vasodilatation. That would be my suggestion. It's very transient. And then, of course, you get nausea. You know, maybe 20%, 25% get a bit of nausea. We didn't have anyone. I think maybe you have one person vomits on out of several hundred on psilocybin. We don't get diarrhea on psilocybin, but you can get a queasy tummy for an hour or so. And those are, to be honest, that's it.
That's it. Some headaches, nausea, one person vomited in hundreds. What about increased heart rate and blood pressure into a danger zone?
No, we didn't have anyone reach into a danger zone.
That matches what the scientists are telling me here in this country, that they haven't had that either. And you're in touch with them, I'm sure. I know you are.
Yes. Maybe 10, you know, 10 millimeters, just like walking up a flight of stairs. You know, that's the kind of effect, isn't it?
But talking about a scientist in this country, we stole Robin from you.
Yes. Well, that just emphasizes how the scientific organization and funding structures in Britain are really rather poor. I mean, what a dumb thing to do. But,
to let somebody like him get stolen by UC Berkeley? I agree.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's still, I think you sort of touched on this a bit earlier, but let me come back to it. I think there's much more resistance in Britain to working in this field because than there is in America. And that's because our government has more control over what people think and can do. What is, you know, the remarkable thing about the US is that the states can vote for change, and they did vote for change with medical cannabis, and they're voting for change for magic mushrooms. In Britain, we don't have that right. Basically, the government dictates to us. We're much more like a kind of communist, Stalinist state than you are. And that's why we've gone from, you know, Robin and I did the first proper brain imaging studies of psilocybin and LSD. In most countries, we would have been celebrated. You know, they'd have poured money into us. We got one grant from the government in 15 years. In America, you know, you've now got dedicated tranches of money from NIDA and vast amounts of money from philanthropists. So you've leapfrogged us and you've stolen him as well. So good luck to you, because, you know, if you're prepared to invest, you deserve it. I mean, I'm disappointed in the UK, but we'll carry on. You know, I'm not going to give up yet, but it is more hard.
By the way, correct me if I'm mistaken, but was it not your research with MRI, LSD on and off that was published on the front page of the New York Times?
I think
Amanda was involved with that, wasn't she? Amanda, yes. Fielding? Yeah.
He was. Yes, we could. And that research was funded by crowdfunding. We asked the public to pay for the scans, and they did.
That was one of the most exciting pieces of data that I've ever seen in my entire career. When I saw those MRIs, I to this day, I can close my eyes and picture those two pieces of MRI on the paper. It was wonderful. I'm so appreciative to that.
Yeah, no, well, it's a good team effort. There's a lot of work goes into doing these studies. You know, it's not just the doctors and the therapist, but it's also you need clever people that can do the analysis of the MRI. We had a wonderful team, and they're beginning to, well, they're dispersed now. That's it. Another one's got it with the California, one of our statisticians, Balazs Getty, and a couple have gone to other universities in the UK. So we're beginning to spread the word, but it would have been nice to have kept them, but we couldn't afford to.
Okay, we talked a little about negative effects with psilocybin. I'm going to take a quick sidebar and then come back to negative effects. Right now, there's a controversy going on in the United States as to whether therapists who guide people on psychedelics, whether the therapists themselves should have psychedelic experience or not. Yeah. And they're arguing both sides. And yeah. What is your opinion on that?
I think it's better to be a good therapist than a psychedelic experienced therapist for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first is there is a tendency for people who've had an interesting and powerful psychedelic trip, and it's very, very meaningful, for them to assume that everyone's going to have the same kind of experience, and to kind of try to be directive and maybe even critical if people don't get the same experiences. So, and you know, you and I have seen this. People who've recovered from addictions, you know, they believe that the way they got better is the only way. You know, I would hate to see that kind of myth perpetuated with psychedelic therapists. The second thing is, and we found this really importantly, particularly in our studies in anorexia. I mean, dealing the psychotherapy of people with anorexia when they are having and coming out of a major psychedelic experience, the challenge is the anorexia, not the psychedelic experience. So you do need therapists that are really competent in that particular aspect of the mental problems. So I'm open-minded. I mean, obviously you can't force people to do something which is illegal still in most countries before they can become a therapist. That would be very unethical. So you can't force people to have psychedelics. If they want to, well, I wouldn't dissuade them. The only point I would make is just don't get arrested, because that makes it very difficult then to be a therapist.
Okay, we talked about negative effects with psilocybin. Let's talk about negative effects with microdosing LSD?
Well, I'm not sure there are any. It's very difficult to know whether there are any negative effects of microdosing. I mean, theoretically, you could say if you microdose every day for 50 years, maybe something could happen. But I'm pretty skeptical. But there is fear mongering still, you know, and there are some people who say, well, LSD's got a bit of an activity at the 5-HT2B receptor, and maybe that'll cause problems in the pulmonary circulation. So we'll have to go away and make a new LSD that doesn't have that. But I think history hasn't shown us any significant problems up till now. So I'm relatively relaxed about it.
What about LSD itself? A psycholytic or a heroic dose?
Yes, I think the challenge and the reason we don't use LSD in our therapy is because you have to admit people into hospital overnight because it's often a 12 or 14 hour trip, and that's not something you can easily deal with in a clinic or out. But I mean, it might be that LSD does have an impact where others don't. One of the very interesting recent studies came out of the group in Switzerland where they took people who were on antidepressant SSRI treatment for anxiety and then gave them LSD. And it seems that LSD might be able to work even if you're on the SSRI. So it might be that actually does have the sort of greater affinity of LSD for the receptor might allow it to be used in people where we think psilocybin may not be as effective.
There's a groundswell of people in the United States who can afford it going to South America and taking ayahuasca. Mm. And there appears to be a lot less research available on ayahuasca. Do you agree with that? That it's hard to find a good research on ayahuasca, so we know less about it?
Very difficult to research ayahuasca because if you get in Western science, it's almost impossible to get ethical permission to give two different drugs because ayahuasca is a combination of two drugs. And on top of that, there are two drugs which come from plant products. So actually gauging the amount of each in an ayahuasca drink is very difficult. So it's almost impossible to appease ethics committees appropriately with that. I mean, I think the great thing about ayahuasca is that it is a drinkable form of DMT, and DMT is clearly a powerful psychedelic. And when we use DMT, we're forced to give it intravenously to avoid the liver metabolism because we cannot give it with the harmaline, the monoamine oxidase inhibitor. And I think it's quite likely that DMT in the shape of ayahuasca is going to be more powerful than DMT given intravenously in terms of giving the bigger therapeutic value. And of course, then you've also got the other very interesting aspect of ayahuasca therapy, which is in a group, and there's all the potential psychological extras you get from being in a group, being supported in a group, etc. So it's plausible that ayahuasca would be maybe even more powerful than what we're doing with psilocybin, but very difficult to research because you can't standardize any of it.
Understood. So this past Friday, I had a tachycardia. My heart rate went up to 134, and I was in an arrhythmia, and I couldn't get out of it for 12 hours by meditation and breathing and various other tools that I have at my personal disposal. So I went to a local emergency room here in Mendocino County, which is 3 hours north west of San Francisco on the coast. And they did something called a cardioversion, where they apply an electrical stimulation to the heart. You're familiar with it. And in order to do the electrical stimulation, they put the patient under anesthesia in order to protect the person from the shock, literally the shock. And so I discussed it with the doctor on duty, asked him what kind of anesthesia he was going to use. And he told me, and I said, well, how would you feel about giving me ketamine? And he said, well, I can arrange that. I said, good. I'd prefer ketamine. So he gave me IV ketamine, and I had a glorious psychedelic experience. But the part of it that I want to share with you that's important is that for me, both personally and professionally, some of these psychedelics that are very powerful and take me into the cosmos don't lend themselves to my being able to take back information or material that I can use to better myself or expand myself or be more creative. It's more like a wonderful ride in what we call Coney Island. It's an amusement park.
I know.
Right? And so, you know, I'm not too interested in just the whole day at an amusement park. I want to learn something because that's my nature. But the ketamine IV was a reminder that a big dose of it is more like an amusement park. Now, share some information about the value of ketamine therapeutically, and then tell us, even though it's not a classic psychedelic, but also, because I'm aware you're schooled in it, but also about adverse effects.
Okay, so, well, as you pointed out, I mean, ketamine produces psychedelic-like experiences. Do you think you could distinguish them from, say, psilocybin or LSD?
It depends on the dose. I would say a large dose of psilocybin would be similar to a IV dose of ketamine in that it's cosmic consciousness. But as I come down in the dose of psilocybin, I find there's more material available to witness and take material from that I can then use every day. When I've done lower doses of ketamine, it's been, again, not rich with material, altered consciousness. I can feel the anesthesia. I've had the experience of merging with another person, my wife and a friend, and it was fun. But I find the psilocybin, from a personal and professional psychotherapeutic perspective, is significantly more valuable.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting that you say that. And this is a topic of great research interest at present. So ketamine, obviously, pharmacologically quite different from psilocybin. Ketamine is a glutamate blocker. Psilocybin, LSD, DMT, or serotonin agonist. If you record the EEG or the MEG on people, or even the fMRI, you find that, though, it's very difficult to disentangle. You couldn't see, obviously, that a ketamine trip was different from a psilocybin or an LSD trip. They produce this powerful disorganization of brain action we call the entropic brain. But there do seem to be other differences in terms, as you say, the value. So the most obvious difference is that the antidepressant effect of ketamine tends to wear off over about 3 or 4 days, whereas the effect of psilocybin can last for weeks or months. And that might be partly because the molecule of ketamine, as well as producing this psychedelic experience, also does tend to block the laying down of memories. And maybe some of the insights that you might get and you'd be able to use under psilocybin are blocked by the ketamine. So it's generally thought that psilocybin is more powerful and more enduring. But then on the other hand, ketamine is legal because it's a medicine for anesthesia. There's now a form of ketamine called S-ketamine, Spravato, which is available for depression. And that's licensed as an add-on. One of the great advantages of ketamine is it will work even if you're on an SSRI, whereas psilocybin sometimes doesn't. So if sometimes you have to stop the SSRI to have the psilocybin effect, whereas ketamine will work on top. So that makes it easier to use. But then you're giving it usually twice a week for a month and then once a week. So you're giving it much more frequently. And then the big downside, I mean, the downside of ketamine is that it's kind of more liked, it's more addictive. Some people get to use it a lot, they get dependent. And then they get bladder problems. if you're using a lot of ketamine, you know, grams a day for weeks or months, you can end up basically destroying the epithelial lining of your bladder and getting terrible cystitis, which can lead to you needing to have the bladder removed, which is obviously a really very major and unpleasant operation.
Oh, my word. Indeed. This is a very important piece of information because people are using ketamine because of its availability in this country. They're using it recreationally, and I've witnessed people using it just, you know, offhand, almost like smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, we have to be careful because ketamine is quite a popular recreational drug in Britain. And
also,
we do see quite a few people. It is quite dependence producing, whereas psychedelics are anti-dependence. And that is another fascinating difference, which we don't understand. Well, that's one of the things I'm trying to do at present is to basically research why they're the same, you know, where they overlap and why they're different.
You know, I've been practicing for over 60 years, David, and I've never run into one case of a person dependent on LSD or psilocybin. Not one case in 60 years. And I've treated everything imaginable.
And that's why it was so despicable that the justification for banning these drugs, banning them from medicine, not just for recreation use, but banning them from medicine, was that they were addictive. I mean, you know, that was exactly the opposite. It was just a falsehood, which was put into the UN conventions, put into your drugs act, put into our drugs act by people who knew they were lying. And we've got 55 years of denial of access. It's very, of all the, you know, millions of people probably would have benefited if they could have kept them as medicines, but they were so, the governments were so terrified and so hateful that they even took them out of medicine because of the recreational use.
What you just said for me is the most painful part of the whole situation, which is the millions of people who could have benefited, tens of millions of people who could have benefited, was it not for this misguided and draconian policies of people with an agenda, so often, you know, backed by financial interests or religious interests or some other kind of personal agenda rather than being open to science. But as you pointed out, there's a whole cadre of people who are anti-science, which is almost, you know, I don't know what to say when I hear that.
Right. Well, programs like yours hopefully will begin to redress that balance.
Okay. What have we missed? Oh, I'm getting a signal from our producer, Charlie Deist, and he says we've got about 5 minutes left. Thank you, Charlie, for coming on. What might you like to add, David, for our listeners that we haven't covered? Anything personal or professional?
Well, yes. I mean, I am very interested in what is happening in America at present. I'm very interested in the Oregon experiment, where they voted in the last election to allow well-being therapy centers with magic mushrooms in localities in Oregon that want it. I believe California and Colorado are going to put it on their ballot in this next election. And that if that program is rolled out carefully and there's good data collected, it could change everyone's attitude towards, certainly, to psilocybin. And the other thing I think is really exciting is the Australian government has basically said, look, the evidence base is so strong now for psilocybin in depression and for MDMA in PTSD. Why don't we just go ahead and let's make it available to doctors? Why wait until someone goes through this regulatory pathway, which, of course, may never happen? It may be companies will just go bankrupt before they get to that point. And Australia just said, come on, let's just allow people to access medical grade versions of these medicines, monitor what's going on, collect what we call real world evidence, basically treat people, monitor what happens, get feedback from the doctors. And that could actually also be a major learning experience for us.
Thank you, David. I think we'll end there. I want to do one thing before we end, and I want to show everybody your book, one of your many books, but this book is the latest one. And I want to talk about this book for just a minute, because there are a lot of books out on psychedelic medicines, including my own, several of my own. But this book is so readable. It's laid out so well, and it is so chock full of information. I can only recommend that you go to Amazon. I hardly, well, those of you who know me know, I don't do this. I don't do commercials. I don't sell products. I have scientists and authors. You all know that. And occasionally I'll put a book up on the screen. But this is really a book that you want to take a look at if you're involved with psychedelics at all. Because of the enormous amount of information presented in such a readable way. Enough said. David, thank you very much for being with us today. It's been a privilege.
Absolute pleasure for me too. Speak again soon, I hope. Thank you.
Okay, that would be wonderful. And thank you all, gentle listeners, for being with us today on this broadcast of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. Remember that we produce a new show every week. You can listen in live on 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning, or just go to our archive. And remember, everything on the archive of mindbodyhealthandpolitics.org is open source. That means no fee to you, no hidden fees, no non-hidden fees. This is information that we want to share with everybody. Go to mindbodyhealthpolitics.org and check out the archive. Until next time, this is Dr. Richard Lewis Miller reminding you that good health is worth fighting for, and it's essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. All right.